This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today I'm talking to Dr. Yeva Yusyunaichi, who is the author of the book Exit Wounds: How America's Guns Fuel Violence Across the Border, published by the University of California Press. Yeva, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Reagan.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk with you about your book. I've been following your work for some time. And before we get to the book, I'm going to ask you to talk about yourself. And in particular, I noticed this, you know, constant theme in your work, in that it takes place on or around borders. And so in the past, you've studied journalists on the Argentine border and first responders on the U.S.-Mexico border. And then this book, Exit Wounds, isn't any different in that it traces the effects of guns as they go across the U.S.-Mexico border. So can you tell us about yourself and what attracts you to borders and how you came to write Exit Wounds?
Yeah, I think I've been obsessed with borders for as long as I can remember. I come from the part of the world in Eastern Europe, from Lithuania, where our borders have shifted very much historically, even during my own lifetime. So I never took them for granted. They were kind of a curiosity for me, something that's artificial and historically shifting and are kind of these projections of power. So they are not really real. They are social political constructs, as we might think as anthropologists. At the same time, they are very real for both for people who do not have the right documents to cross them, or because there are walls or physical barriers, but also for people who endow them with some like big meaning, like ideologies, nationalism, national security, that treat borders as sacred, as the skin of the body politic that we must protect at all costs. So I think that duality has always been a curiosity for me, coupled with another thing. So I've long been interested as an anthropologist in the boundary between law and crime, or legal and illegal, and how borders enforce this kind of difference between what's legal on one side and illegal on the other. And hence we have trafficking, because you can, during the prohibition in the US, you could buy alcohol in Mexico, but not in the United States, and things like that. So how borders kind of create these differences and create crime around them. So Exit Wounds emerged from my last book project, which was Threshold. I studied emergency responders on U.S.-Mexico border and how their work was affected by fortification, like border wall building and militarization of the borderlands. And while I was there, I crossed the border very frequently, both to volunteer and to do research. And I started noticing these signs that said guns and ammunition were illegal in Mexico. So only then I began asking questions. Oh, so maybe Mexico has very different gun laws compared to the United States. And it kind of led from that project into this one, because it was almost a follow-up. A lot of the same questions about state violence and borders and power, except in this project, more attention is paid to the very material tools of violence, the guns and the bullets.
Mm-hmm. Great. And thank you for that introduction. So, and you just mentioned these legal questions around guns. And so the book is called Exit Wounds, How America's Guns Fuel Violence Across the Border. And I just restate the title because there's this implicit, of course, relationship between the United States and Mexico. And you point in the book to this legal asymmetry around gun laws between the U.S. and Mexico. And you say that they, quote, have created a thriving black market for firearms. And so what is this legal asymmetry and how does it relate to the sale of firearms?
Mexico has very strict gun laws. They didn't always have them, but since at least the 1970s, when they passed this federal firearms and explosives law, it is difficult to get firearms. You're very restricted in what kind of guns you can have. If you don't belong to a gun club and you're not a hunter, you can only have one pistol at home for self-defense. It is very, very strict. On the other hand, does it really matter? Because on the U.S. side of the border, there are tens of thousands of licensed gun dealerships, plus gun shows, plus private gun sales. So what happened is that, especially for if we're thinking about organized crime or crime in general, a lot of these guns that appear in crime scenes in Mexico, they come from the United States. It is difficult for people who participate in organized crime to obtain guns legally from Mexican state. There are two gun stores in Mexico, one in Mexico City, one in Monterrey, but they're both run by the Mexican military that imports firearms into the country and then sell it to people. So the other and much easier way, both for common citizens and for members of organized crime to get their firepower is either themselves or hire someone to cross into the United States. And Texas and Arizona, two of the big states bordering Mexico, have very, very weak gun laws. Almost anyone can, well, if you are a U.S. citizen or national, can go into a gun store, buy as many as powerful guns as you can afford, and then the thing is that their market is very much south of the border. And this is related also to another issue, which is a lot of, as I was mentioning, I was working on US-Mexico border with emergency responders. So we are seeing a lot of migrants and asylum seekers who come to the border, but they come here because they are fleeing violence, which is kind of perpetrated by the guns from the United States. So because there is legal asymmetry of who can have a firearm, what kind of firearm, how many between the U.S. and Mexico, it creates this spiral of guns going south, drugs coming north, money going south, and then people fleeing north.
So you mentioned this in your introduction to yourself, that you're interested in these boundaries between the legal and illegal. And so that must have, you know, really that emerged for me in the book as well, in that I saw these several, you know, dualities emerge in the different stories that you're telling. And so one of the dualities came out in your discussion of organized crimes or the drug cartels and the police. And this is because the cartels seem to come out of the police, you know, meaning many of the people in the cartels were former military or police force. But the cartels also worked with the police in some instances. And so there's this blurry line between state-sanctioned violence of the police and the violence of the cartels. And in the book, you have this story of Samara, who's a female member of a cartel, and she recounts her experience. And so I wondered if you could talk about how the cartels are contributing to this story of gun violence that you're telling.
So this is another of those boundaries between law and crime, or between state and legal realm and crime, or the outlaw realm. that I've been very interested in my work until now, in previous projects as well. And in Mexico, this boundary is very porous, as you hinted at. So for many years, it was the state through this one governing party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, that controlled organized crime groups almost like through patronage relationships. So there was this continuity, there were bribes, money going more from organized crime groups to the government, and the government would be protecting organized crime groups. That shifted once democratic elections in Mexico started over two decades ago. There was a lot more instability in the political establishment and their various relationships with organized crime groups. On the other hand, there is also people. So as an ethnographer, I am particularly interested in people, or in the book, I even try to think about people who work for the government and carry guns. So military, the police, and people who carry guns when they work for organized crime group, whether they are sicarios or something like that, they are all violence workers. Unless we add this idea that some violence is legitimate, if we go back to Max Weber's definition of the state and it has the monopoly of the legitimate use of force. So yes, military and police is the legitimate violence, and then this organized crime violence is illegitimate. But if we strip away, if we take away this, who has the power to decide what is legitimate, then they are all violence workers. And these violence workers, they circulate between mostly one way. So from the government, former police and military very often become members of organized crime groups. When they have necessary skills, they are actually targeted for recruitment because they have those necessary skills. So there is this continuity of personnel across this boundary. In the book, I try to avoid using the term cartel as much as possible because of what this word means in U.S. political discourse. And it's a little bit inaccurate of depending whether you can even call these groups cartels. A lot of them now themselves include the word cartel into the name of the group, so it is difficult to avoid it, like the Gulf Cartel or the Cartel Jalisco New Generation. So in that case, I kind of keep that word, but I try to talk about them as organized crime groups because they are much more kind of dynamic as well as fractured than a like concept of the cartel would entail. And Samara is a very important research participant that became a very central character for the book because she's a woman, and there were not that many that I encountered working for organized crime or in any being any kind of violence worker for the government or against the government. But I followed, my interest in this was like how, so organized crime groups are the main buyers of guns from the United States. We know that. They are also the main perpetrators of violence in Mexico, although the government forces are also involved in various human rights violations and have perpetrated massacres and engaged in extrajudicial executions. So that happens too. My question was like, who are these people who are using, smuggling, trafficking guns? Why and how does someone like Samara become of a member of an organized crime group, in her case, the Zetas, which was a very powerful one, a group that was very powerful. So I think understanding who are these people that perpetuate violence is very important in order to get to kind of wrap your mind around what is otherwise like numbers of how many guns just crossed the border. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. I thought Samara's story was very compelling in her, you know, recounting of her experiences working with organized crime. And then you have like the flip side of that, the people maybe on the other side of organized crime, the people who are affected by it. And I saw this other duality that emerges around that, which is this relationship between, I guess, violence and security. And so you have all these people in the book who are, you know, acquiring guns for their own personal use and protection. And so, of course, I thought, you know, so they're in search of safety and security. But, you know, the flip side of this is that, you know, you can have increased, you know, violence and insecurity with all of these flows of guns into Mexico. And so, you know, as people feel more insecure, they may reach for more guns. And, you know, you have these examples of people like Miguel who are, you know, smuggling guns across the border. And so I wondered either how are people managing or thinking about these dual roles or how are you thinking about these dual roles with security and insecurity?
I think you put just the right accent on this other circle of violence that is happening, or the escalation of violence and gun use and gun smuggling as well. Because yes, so once organized crime groups acquired really powerful arsenals from the United States, regular citizens who like Miguel, others, they did not, they were, on the one hand, they were threatened. There was kidnapping, extortion, especially for small businesses and small farmers, people who engage in any kind of private entrepreneurship. So they could not turn to the police or other government structures for justice, because most crimes in Mexico, even if they are reported, they are not investigated. Even for murder, the impunity rate is over 90%. So what did these people do? Well, those who could afford it, they turned to private security. There was a big buildup of private security, armoring your vehicle, installing safe kind of houses inside your house, safe rooms, and also hiring private security guards. But some individuals, and this is where Miguel comes in, also decided to arm themselves or train themselves. So he smuggles guns from the United States, both because he likes hunting, he likes target shooting, but he's also very much into take your security or your safety and your family safety into your own hands. And there are quite a few people like him where they share advice what kind of gun or what kind of bullets to get from the United States, which are more powerful and expensive than the ammunition that they can get in Mexico. So it was important for me to tell these parallel stories of Miguel and Samara, because they're about the same age. Miguel, maybe a few years older, but they grew up in the same city, in Monterrey, second largest city in Mexico, pretty affluent city. But Miguel grew up in the most wealthy part of the city, and he became a businessman. And Samara, her parents migrated to the United States, left her to grow up with her aunts and grandparents. So she was a little neglected as a teenager, and she was abducted and then recruited and made into the worker for organized crime. So it's still the same city, two youths, and their stories kind of intersect and continue in the parallel, because Miguel is getting guns to protect himself against people like Samara who are threatening them. So yes, they are kind of a mirror of the two storylines that I wanted to convey.
Yeah, and then I think, as you said, with this increase in guns, you know, this relates to the increase in violence in Mexico. And then you have this role of news coverage in this whole, you know, also in this story. And you accompany Juan, who's a journalist who seems to cover guns and violence. And it was really interesting because he has to take these various strategies for protection for himself, but then his newspaper wants to use his real name, you know, as his byline. And so and he also visits some pretty kind of gruesome scenes, I think, as well, in as part of his reporting. And so I wondered, you know, what drives journalists to undertake this work? And, you know, do they think about, you know, how this coverage can spark more insecurity and fear as well?
I really like this question. And this almost brings me back to, you know, how we first met when I was working on journalists and you were working in the media. Mm-hmm. So, the thing is that most journalists get into covering crime almost involuntarily, or they fall into it because they are working on a different issue, maybe reporting on just community affairs or local politics, or in Juan's case, it was local business in Nuevo León. And then when violence erupted because there was this more competition between organized crime groups that traffic drugs to the United States, and this violence became more apparent in the communities that journalists were covering, that was just the new story that a lot of them began to pursue. It's also one that once they started this work, it is difficult to get out of it, despite the threats. So one, they become invested in the story or committed to this issue that makes it difficult to kind of abandon because the story doesn't end. The organized crime groups continue competing, the government continues being implicated in extrajudicial killing. So the story has been continuing for many years. It doesn't end. And the journalists who began that beat also feel almost, some of them, I would say, trapped in it. On the one hand, they do have the sources. It's something they are already familiar with. But also, there was, by talking to them and talking to Juan in particular, there is something more to it. So Juan was telling me that he just got submerged into this world of the narco. So it's a dark, kind of dark beat that has a big impact on your mental health, on your family life. But once you get into it, leaving it is... It's hard. There is something to say about leaving the adrenaline behind and the adrenaline of the beat, yes, but it is also something that, although it haunts you, you kind of you're resigned to this, that this is your life, this is what you are good at. So I think maybe in a way it can in some cases be maybe similar to ethnography too. We just get used to, and it's hard to get out.
And so in the book, another group of people that you feature are gun smugglers and the U.S. federal agents who investigate them and who track them and hope to catch the smugglers. Yet the border, it seems to present this problem for U.S. agents in that they don't have jurisdiction in Mexico. And so how much are these, you know, U.S. agents, how much can they accomplish around the flow of guns, you know, with their invests and arrests and with these investigations that they're undertaking?
That's such a good question. So in the U.S., the main agency that's responsible for all federal gun crimes, sort of tracking guns, investigating gun crimes, punishing gun dealers or gun traffickers that violate laws, it is the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And it is one of the least powerful agencies, very understaffed, afraid of political repercussions if they speak up and if they ask for more resources. So I have one chapter in the book that looks back at this operation Fast and Furious that became very politicized And it was about ATF agents letting guns be trafficked to Mexico in order for them to figure out who are the ultimate buyers or where are these guns going to. Well, the fact is that they lost track of a lot of them. And they lost track because their jurisdiction, as you said, ended at the border. Now they are much more careful. So they changed. And I, when I tell the stories of these other agents that I got to spend a lot of time with recently doing this research. So they don't let any guns cross the border. They try to intercept them at any cost before they get into Mexico. But there is this mistrust between US and Mexico, between authorities, the institutions. So it was in Mexico, there is very bad memories of this operation. How could the US government authorize sending guns to organized crime groups in Mexico? And there was nobody was really made responsible for that. And those guns are still in Mexico. But there are also other instances when the DEA agents, Drug Enforcement Administration, they were working on some cases related to organized crime group members that were the Zetas, and they shared the information with their counterparts in Mexico. That information leaked, and this organized crime group executed a lot of people in Allende, Coahuila, which is another place I do write about in the book. So there is this mistrust, both because of what US agents did in the past, and both also of how difficult it is to trust personnel in Mexican institutions that have these relations with organized crime. So it is very difficult. At the same time, it is the only way, because guns kind of it's very difficult to solve an international trafficking crime only working in one country. So I don't know. As an anthropologist, I don't know whether I can offer solutions for how they can increase cooperation, but that's definitely the only way forward.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned trust and mistrust just now, and kind of that leads me to the next question, which was, what was it like doing this research? And I asked that because, in particular, there was a moment when you're talking to a particular man, and you're talking to him and about his guns, and he mentions that his smuggler was arrested in Texas, and he says to you, "I hope you had nothing to do with that." And he seems to be joking or saying it, you know, kind of lightly. But it was in that moment when I really thought about you and your vulnerability and, you know, how you're possibly the stranger, you know, kind of floating into town, as sometimes ethnographers are, and asking these questions about illegal matters with people. And so, I thought about you there, you know, with this person and how you could be possibly mistaken or some such thing. And so I wondered, how did you manage this potential suspicion or unease in a situation where it might be difficult to build trust as well?
There is so much in that sentence, and I am really glad that you picked it up, because I didn't say anything more or like didn't expand on it. I left it as hanging there for people to kind of dwell on it and see, like, think what does this really mean. So I am delighted to hear that that you got it. So it does, yes, it hints to suspicion that lurked underneath many relationships even after a long time. His comment was meant probably as a joke, but also not a joke, like that latent possibility. When I began doing this research, there was one thing that I there were many rules kind of guidelines I lived by, but one of them was to be transparent and very open about what I do. So there were some things I wouldn't do. I would not go and say, oh, I want to buy a gun and see what I could. I was there and told everyone that I am interested in what American guns are doing in Mexico. I want to write a book. Please talk to me. And ethnography puts you into such positions. Maybe it always takes time to build trust. Yes, maybe more time when what people do is illegal. And many people, the thing is that many people never agreed to talk to me. I kept calling them. I kept talking to them. I kept emailing them. I tried all kinds of ways to persuade them to kind of share their stories. But some of them were too suspicious of me, even after several months, even after kind of Miguel and some others who shared their stories said she's okay. So a lot of people didn't. There was never that trust. But like in life, some people are more willing to risk and to accept you and to take a leap of faith, maybe. And Mikhail was just like that. He was really, you know, into kind of guns. But Anise never went away entirely. This was also because of the structure of this fieldwork. So this fieldwork was very, very different from my previous one with emergency responders, because even in that one, most of my research participants were men, and I spent days and nights in their company, but there was this camaraderie, there was this kind of group, there was this community. In like doing this field work, I spent, sometimes hanging out in gun clubs and sometimes going out to various social events or to public events or gun buyback programs. But a lot of the interviews and a lot of, accompanying people took place in this the structure where it's one-on-one. It's me as an anthropologist and then this one other person, which in most situations was a man. So that added another unease to this whole situation of just studying illegal practices. I tried to do various things. I think one that really helped me is to take breaks. So I would do field work for a few weeks or a month, and then I would come back to Boston because I wanted to have a week or something where I can let my guard down, where I don't have to always think, should I go to this interview? Is this too risky? Is it too late at night? Should I say no? And that weighing of where, like, how much is it worth risking to get this field work and this story done? That was also hard. And hard when I said no and doubted myself. So taking breaks really helped. But in the end, I don't know. I think only time will show the people I worked with that if nothing bad comes their way, that I was not a threat to them. Since I am back and I'm okay, it turned out that they are not a threat to me. And this is one of the most rewarding parts of ethnography, that you build trust with people, even people you don't necessarily like, or their ideas or political opinions you might not like, or even people you might be afraid of. But if you stick around for the duration that it takes to do research, then this relationship develops that's maybe always somewhat threatening to break, if maybe always some suspicion, even if it's expressed in joke form. But it's the stuff of anthropology.
Yeah, and that's really helpful to hear how you broke up the field work, going in, coming back in those kinds of time durations, in order to think about, you know, how to carry out this kind of work. Because many times we're presented with this one way of going to the field and staying there for, you know, a year or some such thing, but, you know, we have to think about other ways of doing things. And I think too, maybe that's leads to this next question, where you just kind of mentioned this, but you wrote the book in short chapters, and they're mainly focused on small numbers of people or, you know, particular interactions in each chapter. And your titles are also very, you know, very clever and evocative. And so I wondered if these chapter lengths evoke the nature of the field work, or, you know, why you chose this kind of structure for the book.
It's both structural and or like about the nature of fieldwork, but also the fact that I knew that I wanted to write a braided narrative. So first of all, for the fieldwork part, in order to do participant observation at gun buyback programs, for example, or talk to these federal agents in the United States, I had to do it in different regions and somewhat different timelines than when I was hanging out with organized crime groups, because I didn't want to even involuntarily pass some kind of information to betray trust or like cross boundaries. So, for example, when I was working with federal agents, that was in Arizona. But when I was working with organized crime groups in Mexico, it wasn't in Sonora. So it wasn't the same group that these agents were kind of following to see where the guns were going. I work with organized crime groups in Tamaulipas, in Nuevo León, in northeast part of Mexico, so that whatever they were doing were not connected to these agents I was working. So in a way, because fieldwork was like that, there were multiple stories, but it was also intentional on my part because it's not like gun traffickers are a bunch of, you know, they're not like firefighters who you can go to a fire station and just hang out with them and do kind of immersive, embedded and embodied field work. These are people who maybe once they buy a gun and then nothing really happens with that gun for like several weeks. So hanging out with them all the time didn't make all like a lot of sense. I had to switch perspectives and I had to kind of wait a longer time to go back to them because, oh, there is another kind of episode that involves the gun in their life that I can now pick it up. And I wanted to see the more complex and more wholesome picture of what U.S. guns are doing in Mexico. So not working only with the victims or survivors of organized crime violence or only people who are like gun enthusiasts and hunters or people who are maybe gang members and work for organized crime. I wanted to show that guns have these multiple lives or affect multiple people and their lives in Mexico. So that required me to tell their stories. And I chose small chapters because I think I was reading a lot of fiction that had braided narrative. And you come back to the same character and again and again. But to do that, you have to make your chapters short. Otherwise, it will be like 1,000-page book. But also writing a book about gun violence, I wanted to write it so that people would want to read it. It's not like you walk into a bookshop and pick up the book about gun violence unless you are a scholar studying gun violence, but people don't want to read these depressing books. So I thought, how can I create a story line that people, that would be a page turner, that people would, yes, there will be violence and they will learn about really heavy stuff, but also want to follow and see what happens to these people. So it was both about field work, how it happened, and like my strategic choices, but also how I decided to style the book in order for it to be readable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was definitely readable and a page turner, and the page turning was kind of facilitated by the order of the chapters and the focus, in that some chapters zero in on people and then some chapters maybe take a broader perspective on like history or laws. And then some characters come back in different chapters toward the end. So yeah, so it was a very readable book, which I know people will really, really, really like that part of it.
Yeah, thank you. Actually, one other reason, like tiny one, of why I made this braided narrative, I was also thinking that it could be very interesting to teach a subject as complicated as gun trafficking or gun violence between US and Mexico, and have students only read like different storylines. So you could read Samara's chapters, or you could read Miguel's chapters. Maybe everyone reads more background and history chapters, and then you meet and discuss like, how does this look from that character's perspective? So a little bit thinking about that too, although it hasn't been taught yet, so I don't know whether it will work that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned that. So I'm sure that it will be. And so you mentioned this earlier, these gun buyback programs. And so you offer, you know, some potential solutions or responses to gun violence at the end of the book. And then you talk about these homegrown responses of these gun buyback programs. And you also mentioned potential policies. And so I wondered if you could talk about that. How are people responding to this issue of gun violence, or, you know, how could people respond to this issue?
I think the first step in responding to this is understanding of how many pieces, failed policies in both US and Mexico are responsible for this situation. So the book is not really a kind of straightforward policy manual or any policy manual, but in the end I do offer some very, very tangible solutions, from like having smart guns that thieves would not be able to use, like we have thumb scans on our phones, but also it's not only about laws. We cannot find our way out of this problem through law outlawing this or that alone, because as long as there is demand for guns in Mexico, and guns last a long time, so the ones that are already there will last a long time. Now there is a lot of focus on smuggling ammunition, because they need to replenish ammunition once it's spent, and the main market is still the United States. So I think we kind of need to understand why this violence is happening, and that's related to such things as addiction to drugs in the United States. There is an aspect of poverty, the whole structure of the global economy that kind of makes certain people more vulnerable of being recruited to organized crime because there are no other employment opportunities. So serious limitations of the justice system in Mexico, as well as responsibility or refusal to take responsibility by our firearms industry in the United States, that makes a lot of profit from selling guns that they know end up in Mexico, and Mexican government is now pursuing a lawsuit against them. So we'll see where that goes.
And so finally, this question switches maybe to your work with books yourself. And so you wear many hats. You are a researcher, a writer, a professor at Brown University, but you also edit a series on public anthropology at the University of California Press. And so, of course, this is the New Books Network that we're talking on, and you have this hand in facilitating the publication of new books. So I wanted to ask you about this series, and I wanted to ask, you know, how you're thinking about public anthropology, what your aims are with this series, and, you know, how you choose the books that you publish in the series.
Thank you so much for that question. I love talking about how books come to be. So I inherited Public Anthropology series. It was started by Rolf Borofsky. And I've been, I think, the series editor for a few years now, so I've seen some books being published. The main thing is that these books are on issues that are of public concern. So it can be anything: human rights, public health, environmental justice, education. It has to matter to people outside academia, like really matter. Like, why should my neighbor or your neighbor care about this? How does it affect them? Not just as a curiosity to develop theory, which is wonderful. There have to be books like that, but that's where, like, I draw the boundary. What is public anthropology and what is not? Anything can be public. Bike lanes or TikTok. I think it is very hard for first book authors harder to do that, unless you're already working on a subject that has, like, very broad public appeal. You try to write a book that fulfills the expectations of various audiences. Primary of them is probably your tenure committee or your colleagues. And that's a very different audience. And you want to write in different style and perform knowledge and show different things for them than you would write for your neighbor. So it is delicate. I think any book can kind of be made more publicly accessible. The strengths in the series kind of continue, you know, on migration and medical anthropology and public health. So a lot of people who work on these issues, they contact me, or they contact Kate Marshall, who is kind of my counterpart at the University of California Press. She oversees the whole anthropology list. So the book has to fit in her list as anthropology, and then it has to be kind of included in, like, a series, which would be my list. So we kind of work together. We also approach people. Like, we reach out when I see someone is writing a book on, you know, I see on social media, or I go to a conference panel, or here any other way somebody says, oh, somebody wrote such a fantastic dissertation. I reach out to people and I try to meet with them, and I say, oh, would you consider public anthropology serious? So it's both. We review submissions and we try to be proactive. More recently, we've had more interest in environmental justice issues, but it is also hard to get into these new fields because the series is so well known for these topics that we've been publishing a lot for many years, and those scholars know how to pitch to the series. At the same time, we might have some books in the pipeline, but for example, when the whole reckoning with police violence and kind of racial injustice in the United States started, it was very disappointing that people did not want to reach out to public anthropology series. At the same time, I was not surprised, because when I looked at the backlist of what books were published, well, we didn't really publish anything on the subject before. So there is a lot of work to kind of build your list going forward. And it will take me some years to do that.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think it was very helpful for people who are possibly looking for a home for their book, or thinking about how these series work, or thinking about, you know, what is public anthropology. So that's really, really great. And so the last question is, now that Exit Wounds is out into the world, what are you thinking about working on next, or what projects are you, you know, preparing for the future?
I was dreading this question. I love this question when you ask other authors. I'm like, ooh, what are they working on? And I thought, what will I tell Reagan? Until now, I've always tended to fall into my next project while doing my previous one. So when I was doing Savage Frontier, my dissertation research, I started working with fire departments. So my next project became Threshold, about emergency responders, while I was there. As I said, I fell into this gun project because I guns were smuggled going in the opposite direction than the people we were treating coming from. So one thing that emerged for me during this field work is that a lot of organized crime group leaders, they all were extradited from Mexico, and they continue to be extradited. And we know the famous cases like El Chapo, but there are many, many others. They are charged with various drug charges, and then they sit in prison in the United States. But then there is no reckoning with violence that they perpetrated in Mexico. They never face justice for murders or for extortion. So what happens when justice is exported? What happens to the communities in Mexico where these leaders are just plucked out and sent to the U.S. made kind of repent for the crimes, U.S. laws that they violated, but nothing in Mexico. So there is no kind of justice. So I went to work on extraditions. At the same time, I do feel this pull already, although my book is only coming out next week. I already went to go back to the field, but I'm also, for the first time, really wary. I've done now 3 long-term ethnographic projects, and ethnographic research takes a toll. Maybe I still feel the bruises. Maybe they need to heal because, well, as you know, when we do ethnographic research, we form these deep relationships. Like, we bring people into our lives, and it is hard to do it again and then again. Yes, by now I already know, like, the how. So I can do field work pretty easily. But am I ready? Can I do it again? Not just to go through the motions, but to go all in, to kind of become permeable to other lives. And especially when I work with people who engage in violence or who experience violence, and people who kind of hurt you or can hurt you. So I, as I was saying about this, how I managed this last field work and kind of managed to continue it despite the unease and fear, I think I might need a little break before I do this extradition project, or else I need to pace myself, or maybe collaborate with someone, which is something I haven't really done, and I would really like to do collaborative research. One thing I do know is that I cannot not be an ethnographer, so we'll see.
Great. That's a great place to leave off. And I think that's a great answer, because whenever I ask the question, I don't like to put the pressure on and repeat this idea of like continuous productivity. And sometimes I also think people could say, well, you know, my next project is to relax or take a break or some other such thing. And so, you know, we wish you well with that, with the coming up with the next project and sort of recuperating and thinking about moving on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for that. Thank you for telling us about Exit Wounds. So I'm Reagan Gillum, and I've been talking to Dr. Yeva Yosionaiti, who is the author of the book Exit Wounds, How America's Guns Fuel Violence Across the Border, published by the University of California Press. And thank you for writing this book, and thank you for sharing it with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.